Over the next hour, we'll be giving a glimpse into the world of mainstream mass media, specifically how it relates to science, with a unique perspective from inside nature. We'll start off with a talk from veteran science journalist and editor Ivan Semenik for 45 minutes or so, followed by a short talk from Lisa about how external relations can help if media should ever call you. While this session deals with mass media and how we can help with incoming calls from journalists, I also wanted to flag how Perimeter's publications department is always interested in learning about research developments here at Perimeter or elsewhere for possible inclusion in Perimeter's outgoing materials. If that's something you're interested in, please feel free to contact Natasha Waxman. So before we switch to Ivan, let me tell you a bit about him. Ivan Semenik is a science journalist, editor, broadcaster, and the U.S. Chief of Correspondents for Nature, based in Washington, D.C. Some of you may remember Ivan from September 2011, where he moderated a panel discussion here in this theater about Stephen Hawking and the power of ideas, tied to the grand opening celebrations. Ivan is truly an expert in his field. He's covered science policy for magazines, television, and online media in the U.S. and Canada for over 18 years. But I'll leave it up to him to share some of that history with you. So now over to Ivan.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start by looking at my watch to see how we're doing, it's very nice to be here, I have to say, especially to see so many familiar and friendly faces. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about what we do at Nature and more broadly in the profession of science journalism and science communication. It's funny to hear yourself described as an expert, and I think what that means, at least for me now at this point, is it means I've passed the stage of making sweeping statements and grand insights, and I've now evolved to making small, useful observations after several years in the business in various ways. And the 18 years is more or less how I count my time as a science journalist. It's more or less how I count my time from the first time I was able to sell a story to a publication and make a small bit of income from that and gradually made that full time. But before I was doing that, I was also still in science communication, so it's been about 25 years for me in one form or another bringing science to a broader audience. I started off actually working at the Ontario Science Centre, developing exhibits and programs there. I mention that actually because it's relevant to this. I was thinking about kind of just looking back and thinking how does this all fit together, and I'm kind of realizing some of the it's interesting now to think about what preoccupied me at different points as I was kind of coming into the field of science communication and then into journalism. So I would say the first 10 years or so that I was involved in this work, I was mainly preoccupied with how to explain things in a very serious and almost deeply philosophical way. You can really get into the act of explanation and what is explanation, what is a good explanation, what's the point of explanation, and at the heart of good science journalism, there often is, there is a talent for adept explanation of an unpacking of complex ideas without losing the nuance. So that preoccupied me a great deal for the first 10 years or so that I was doing this. And I began to, maybe in the Canadian way, began to imagine the role as a kind of guide across a landscape, perhaps the landscape generated by scientists and researchers and creating the appropriate tours or the appropriate journeys through that landscape in a way that would not only impart information but somehow allow people to grow as a consequence of that experience. Then I moved into journalism, things got way more cynical, but what preoccupied me after that, I actually moved into television. I was working for Discovery Channel for many years, producing stories and documentaries. And at that point, the lesson for me was the importance of storytelling. And that also has kind of a deep root to it, because it leads you into asking how humans are wired to receive information. And if you're trying to impart complex information or controversial information, it's important to know how people are built to pick it up. And so, you know, it's no secret that we're born storytellers, we're born story listeners. Listening to stories is something that children do even before they're verbal. And the wiring is there, and as you sort of move on in the field, you can learn to use the tools and use the wiring to get across complicated ideas about science and science policy. So that preoccupied me for quite a while. Now, since then, I moved on into print and text media, online media, different sorts of things, newspapers, magazines. I was a bureau chief for New Scientist for a number of years, and more recently, I've been basically the U.S. news editor for Nature, based in Washington. Now, what preoccupies me day to day is how to say something that someone hasn't said already, especially something that maybe some people would prefer not be said. So, and that's sort of kind of deeper into the harder edge of journalism, and that also has its own rewards. And so far, I would say in some ways it's the biggest challenge of all. So I work with a team of about a dozen journalists, either staff or longtime freelancers, and you know we try to cover the bases in science and science policy in the U.S. And there's an equivalent team doing the same thing in the UK and Europe. So I'm going to mention a little bit more about Nature because when I took the job, one of my motivations, I was telling people at lunch, was I was always curious at how Nature really worked. And I'm sure many of you have that same feeling. If you have any, you know, if you're in a scientific career, regardless of your field, there's always that sense, how does nature really work? And from a journalist's point of view, it's a little bit interesting because nature is more than one thing. Of course, most of us associate it with the peer-reviewed papers and literature at the back half. Nature has a long history, particularly in experimental physics, of publishing landmark papers or rejecting landmark papers. You know, like I think Nature didn't believe in the neutrino originally, and some other famous moments like that. So most scientists think of Nature with the peer-reviewed back half, and so if you're in the environs of Nature. You learn right away that it's actually two publications in one. So I've just brought a recent issue, and if you haven't actually, most people don't actually pick up paper magazines anymore, but if you happen to see one of these in the library, it's interesting to kind of put your hand right about halfway through, and you'll see this kind of blue banner, that's the way it's identified right now, that says in bold letters, research. And basically everything back of this is peer-reviewed. It's either the News and Views, which are written by scientists or kind of overview articles, and then of course we have the letters and published papers and results and so on. So this is all more or less peer reviewed. There's also a career section at the back, but I'll sort of just blip over that. That's the peer reviewed half. We call that the back half. It's a completely separate world. One thing that surprised me when I came on board was just how truly separate it is. I always imagined that Nature reporters had all kinds of extra special inside information because they would actually get to see the process of science literature in the making. But actually it's quite an arm's length process, and it has to be, because a lot of the science that we're reporting on sometimes appears in the peer-reviewed section of Nature. Sometimes papers are retracted. Sometimes there are scandals associated with what goes on or what has appeared in the back half, and we need to be prepared to cover that as journalists, which we do as though we were working for some other company. So it's actually quite separate. I mean, it's not as though we don't talk to each other, but we are definitely, on any given moment, we tend not to have much more of a jump on what's happening in Nature than any other journalists would. So then the front half is more of a science magazine. You know, you can sort of see it in the This Week section. So if you pick it up, and there'll be editorials, news, features, opinion, comment, more of the kinds of things you would see in a magazine. These are written by journalists, typically edited by editors, and put together as a sort of weekly news magazine of science, particularly for professional researchers. But broad enough that people outside of science could also pick it up. So anyone in the world who would want to know what's really happening in science this week that's important to scientists, or in what way is science impinging on the world, or in what way is it overlapping with events of the world? You know, for example, There's going to be a presidential election in Mexico in a couple of weeks. How might that affect research in Mexico? Those kinds of questions that might be of interest to professional researchers, that's the kind of thing we would cover in the front half. So that sort of explains where we're coming from. And now I'm going to move from that to talking a little bit more about the basic job of trying to cover science in that way broadly. So I have a slightly different title than the one that we saw in the earlier slide, so I sort of thought I'd get to the point. And of course, one of the big challenges in science journalism is trying to figure out what's worth covering, what is real, what's not real, and it's something that over which opinions are often very divided, so that explains the title. I'm going to start with this little cartoon that many people have seen before. It's from PhD Comics, which are quite well known now, and it's basically, just to make it very brief, it's the science news cycle. It charts the course of a particular result by a graduate student, you know, and sort of you see at the top of the cycle is the result, you know, very, very carefully stated in literature. That's your research. A is correlated with B, with a p value there, given C, assuming D and under E conditions, and then you kind of you see how it goes through the university PR. University PR office, the news wires, how the internet deals with it, how bloggers deal with it, and local news, and eventually it gets to your grandmother who's wearing a tinfoil hat to ward off A, whatever that might be in the original paper. So this is sadly true, but I guess the idea is that science journalism is meant to be a kind of antidote to this, that in fact there is some sense in a group of, or a profession of journalists who actually cover science full time with some knowledge and can make more critical assessments of what constitutes news and what's truly significant to the larger audience. So I thought I'd start off by giving you a sense of what it's like to be in the mind of a science journalist. It's probably a scary thought, since it could also be scary to imagine being in the mind of a theoretical physicist. But anyway, let's just contrast those two environments for a moment. A young scientist, there's the classic scene of kind of curiosity and inspiration. Like many professions, science is driven by kind of inputs and outputs, and you can imagine what they might be for science. I'm sure you could all fill in the blanks for this. What are your inputs? What are your outputs? You could imagine observations, data sets, insights, various things that feed into a scientific imagination, and then how those observations about the world are processed, manipulated, and outcomes a product of some kind, which might be, you know, a scientific paper, or more to the point, some genuine insight about the natural world. So a lot of people have that tendency. I think we all have a sense that that all of us are scientists. Many people say that all of us are scientists. We're born scientists. Children are born scientists. And eventually some people lose that, and the people who manage not to lose it go on to become professional scientists. So, and there are various clues and signs that you might want to be a scientist. So many of you probably have experienced that in life as you develop. There are also clues that you might be a science journalist. So in that case, if you're the kind of person who, you know, and here's, of course, the world's most famous journalist. So if you have an inkling, a sense in your life that your inputs are in the form of sources, in the form of getting information from others, in the form of drawing from what's going on around you, and also that the outputs are kind of coming in the form of stories. If you like to tell stories about what you've heard, or if you can't wait to explain something, that's one of the clues. When we hire a number of interns in our office in Washington, D.C., and it's quite a serious internship. It's a big commitment, a lot of policy and heavy-duty stuff. People are covering OSTP and lots of other government agencies, but it's fun to find out when we bring in interns what got them in the field in the first place. And at the base, there's almost always that sense that as soon as they learn something, when they were students, as soon as they discovered something, they just couldn't wait to somehow get that off their chest. They had to tell someone about it in some way. So that's a clue that you might be. I mean, I think that also applies for teaching as well, but I think with journalism, there's also this extra desire to have the latest information and to keep imparting the new stuff. Here's what just happened. Oh, guess what I've just heard. So there's clues. Now, when you go into that, you know, as your brain, as the journalist's brain evolves, the other factor that becomes quite important is this idea of editorial independence, that you're imparting this information actually for the benefit of the listener. It's very easy, or the benefit of the audience. And it is very cynical to be, it's very easy to be cynical about this because you can always, you know, like Bob Dylan says, right? Everyone, you gotta serve somebody, right? Everyone somehow is beholden to someone. But the principle behind sort of media in a free society is that, to some extent, that it's being presented for the public good in the public interest, and that there are no hidden, I mean, again, it's very easy to be cynical here, but there are no hidden strings as to why that information is being brought to you, apart from you know, a team of people that are thinking this is what is in the public's interest to know. So it's part of that sense of telling the stories, not because it serves somebody else's interests for me to tell you this information, but it's actually better for you if I tell you this information. And I remember coming to that insight early on because I was a science undergraduate and very much thought of myself as sort of heading in the direction of a scientific career. And once I kind of moved over into the communication line and especially into journalism, I would often have, either from former professors or friends of mine who remained in the sciences, would say things like, oh, this is good. Like, we need people like you to tell our story, to promote what we're doing, to tell the public how important that is. You know, and that to some extent that might be true. It's, of course, it's important for the public to know what researchers are doing, especially publicly funded researchers. But I remember coming to that insight privately. Actually, I'm not really here for you, as you know, being told that, because it's really a matter of being the public's representative to see what is going on, to kind of open the door to science. And one of the big transitions that I think someone makes when they're moving into that career, if there's someone who's very enthusiastic about science and they kind of picture themselves as a scientific person, is to make that transition to say, I'm not actually an insider in this world, I'm an outsider who's trying to allow everyone to look in and see how fascinating it is, how complicated it is, and perhaps how, you know, sometimes it's not so nice either. So you know, all the different facets and all the different ways that world needs to be looked at. And then, of course, once you really start doing it for a living, you quickly understand that there are also business realities that affect what you do as a journalist, what you report, and why. And these come in many, many forms, because depending on exactly what kind of content you're producing, you know, how does that content earn income? What are the, you know, what is the audience asking for, and also what are the competitors doing? What's the landscape like? How does it fit into the big picture? So these are all, and that's an area that's changing wildly right now. So these are all the different forces at work that eventually shape a journalist's brain. Now, you could also easily say, and many people do, that, well, why do you need these science journalists running around? Because there are a lot of other ways that you can receive information about science, and here are just a few of them. So for example, I've got Futurity, which is a website created by research universities that put out articles about what they're doing. So you could learn a lot about research that's going on at universities by going to, say, Futurity or similar sites. Of course, NASA is, you know, world leader in communicating science, and it's a big part of their mandate. NASA television, you could watch it all day and learn all sorts of things about science. It's a tremendous outreach and education outlet. You could follow individual scientists on Twitter. People could be tweeting right from their labs, talking about what they're doing, talking about the life of science. You can have all sorts of blogs and people on Twitter and other streams talking about what they do as they do it. Why have the journalist as the intermediary when you can get right from the scientist? And industry as well has its own streams. You know, there are industry representatives, you know, for any major science or technological industry, pharmaceutical, you name it, have all sorts of tools for creating news or packaging news about what they're doing. I just grabbed a frame recently from something that's called Pharma Television, which is basically put out as a kind of news channel about the pharma industry. Of course, the thing about all of these is there's what's missing in some of these is a level of criticism. You know, NASA's not going to run something that's critical of NASA on NASA TV. On Futurity, you're not going to read stories that are critical about research at some of these universities. So what's missing there is that sort of editorial independence, and that's the point. And so, I was going to say, by the way, that another model, and it's one that I would laud, actually, is independent institutes like this one can find themselves dissatisfied with how their research is portrayed in the public and can take it upon themselves to underwrite a major effort to communicate what they're doing to the public. So the Quantum Tamers, I thought, was an excellent example of this. Having worked in television, I can imagine how difficult it would be to sell this as a documentary, even to Nova or, you know, and certainly to many other mainstream broadcasters where you would say, you know, we really want to have, you know, an hour-long documentary about quantum computing, and you could just imagine what the response would be from programmers and from executive producers, you know, considering the cost, and right away, you know, the sense would be, well, how can we justify that? There aren't enough people that would want to know about that. Well, instead, you know, Perimeter takes it upon itself to say, we're just going to produce this, or we're going to underwrite its production, and something wonderful is created as a result. So, or something that's, you know, at least up to the standard of what else would be out there. Anyway, here are some recent headlines from Nature, the kinds of things that you would not see on those in those other avenues. You know, so, you know, right up atop is a story that I worked on with a writer about the question of the awarding of grants to a Texas Cancer Institute that basically amounted to about $20 million given out in 10 days with no peer review, and a lot of people wondering why did this happen. So we have a Romanian prime minister. This is a story we broke this week. Basically caught in the act, you know, caught plagiarizing in some of his student days. And then, and here we have just from last night, a story that we put up about what's happening in Rio and whether or not the negotiated deal that's already on the table in Rio is actually going to amount to anything. These are all critical stories that involve looking at them from many different angles. There are science content in all of these stories, but also they involve money, decision-making, power, and so on. And so that's also the kind of work that we do, and the journalists that we employ are experts in pulling apart this kind of stuff and poking at what's really going on in the profession of science in all its forms. So I'm not going to drag you through all this text. I was going to say that it hasn't always been this way. And that, in fact, in the early days, science journalism kind of emerged from an idea among editors. I think this goes back to the early 1900s, you know, where major U.S. newspapers were kind of adopting that progressive idea that technology is transforming society. It was already obvious, or is beginning to become obvious at the beginning of the 20th century, and that should somehow be documented. And so writers who began to pay attention to how science and technology was changing the world began to appear at major newspapers, like the New York Times, for example, as early as the early 1900s. Now, those early days were very positive towards science because it was that progressive attitude. This is what's going to pull the world out of its never-ending cycle of, you know, violence and despair and all of the other problems that never seem to go away, that, you know, that ultimately science was going to move society forward. So that carries right on into the 30s and 40s, and so you find, you know, things that happen, like the use of nuclear weapons, for example, treated in a fairly uncritical way, even to the extent that, you know, so, for example, a science writer for the New York Times, William Lawrence, was also writing press releases for the War Department, and the time that was not considered unusual. That would be, you know, unheard of today. But that just shows you how much we've changed since the 1940s. So, and then actually things very quickly turn, because once you get into the 50s and 60s, of course with the 50s, you know, and Sputnik and so on, there's this massive investment in science, especially in the US. And then you get to a point where there's more distrust, more criticism, you know, things, landmarks like Silent Spring and kind of starting the environmental movement, other, you know, the CIA experiments, you name it, all the way up to, you know, sort of the Challenger explosion, which first kind of put chinks in how NASA was being covered in the media. There were just many ways in which there's a kind of disenchantment or a realization among those who cover science that actually they need to be a lot more critical. And that sort of dominated the next era. At the same time, there were more specialty science publications coming online, like, you know, or some that were already there, like Scientific American, became more popular. Others sprang into being, like, say, Discover Magazine, or the New York Times Science Section, or Nova, the television series. These all kind of were products of the 70s and 80s. Sometimes it's called the golden age of science journalism, because there was money and, you know, people were pursuing this profession. You began to have professional programs. For example, today one of the best programs, if you're training to become a science journalist, is at the University of California, Santa Cruz. That program was launched in 1981. And you kind of get a sense that there's a professionalization of the whole field. So the next big change, though, comes in the mid-90s with the arrival of the internet, with the World Wide Web, and all of the promise that it holds for revolutionizing media in all its forms, converging, changing, you know, transforming media, and of course, playing havoc with the business models that support traditional media. And so science journalists, like others, have been affected by that. So you know, kind of the more recent period of history, that's been a defining feature of the profession. So this has been, my purpose here is just to show you what's at work in the environment around a science journalist who's doing what he or she is doing. And now I can give you a sense that there are obviously comparisons and similarities with researchers in the sciences. Here are some areas where journalists and scientists have a lot in common. The work tends to be very creative and very stimulating. Storytelling is very creative work, just as research is. It can also be resource challenged. This is not at the high end of society's pay scale. This is not the financial services sector, whether you're a researcher or a journalist. So you're often dealing with challenges that way. There is travel, though. There is communication. There is a sense of going where the action is. This was especially true when I was working in television, because you have to have a camera to actually show stuff. You can't just pick up the phone. But it's true even at Nature. I have a reporter right now in Brazil covering the Earth Summit and was on a very bad staticky phone conversation with him this morning and trying to figure out what we need to talk about there. And finally, you don't usually have to wear a business suit. So those are some of the comparisons between what goes on here at Perimeter and what goes on in our newsrooms. But let me talk about the differences. And I'm going to grossly generalize, and I think it's very risky to speak to a group of people about how they think or what defines their profession. But my observations are, these are just my observations, that in some ways I've come to think of science and scientists as constrained by nature. That, you know, not constrained by their nature, but by nature out there, nature with a capital N. Not nature with a little n. We're nature with a little n. Nature is going to offer you information or not. You know, whether it's dark energy or dark matter or you know, just information about falling bodies. You know, nature will define what you can say and not say, or what you can interpret or not interpret. And it ultimately is what constrains what a scientist can say about reality. And in a different way, journalists are constrained by human nature in the sense that in the way that people can receive information. This goes back to what I said earlier about how people are wired. And so the way in which people can take in information defines what and how you say. Also, the inputs are different. You know, if you're in science, you're dealing with information about the natural world, whether it's, you know, data, and maybe you're manipulating that data in some sort of, you know, using some sorts of operators or something, you're doing something to it. And it's a different world in journalism where you're in a kind of narrative domain. You're dealing with actors and actions. You're dealing with people doing stuff and then trying to figure out what to say about what they're doing. And then finally, there's a tendency, I think, in science where you're looking for the broad message, the general case. You know, you're looking at the specific thing, perhaps. This is especially true in observational science. You might be looking at something very specific and trying to make broader inferences, a general case. And in a sense, in journalism, often you're going in the opposite direction. You're trying to hone in on the specific. You're trying to find a new angle, a fresh, unique thing that might be quite specific to say about something. And so those forces sometimes lead you in opposite directions, and that actually accounts for some of the reasons why it's actually difficult for journalists and scientists to communicate sometimes. It has to do with what the forces that are at play. But in the end, in a sense, if you're a scientist, in a way you're kind of reporting about the world, or you're trying to say something about what you perceive about the world, and if you're a journalist, you're trying to not so much tell, I mean, you might be a reporter, but what you're really trying to do is tell a story. And you're trying to build a story. And that includes emotion. And that's one of the biggest differences. In fact, one of the things that drives scientists crazy, many scientists crazy, and I've seen this on many blogs, and I've seen people talk about this, is they can't stand it when reporters ask them how they feel about something. Like, how did you feel when you made that discovery, or when you had that insight, or how did it feel to be whatever? And I have to say, especially younger researchers, often just do not see the point at all in that question. And they will say, they'll get very pedagogical and say, how I feel has nothing to do with it. This is science and blah, 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 and you know, this is an objective thing, and you know, what really matters is, you know, what we're seeing about nature. And that's all true. But in fact, one of the things about, and this is about being constrained by human nature, one of the things about humans and the way they take in information is that emotion and feelings are the key filter that we use to pay attention to stuff or not pay attention to stuff. We're surrounded by information of all forms at all times. And the information that tends to stick with us is information that we feel something about. And one of the ways that happens is through empathy. So, you know, television, for example, is often criticized as being a completely superficial, pointless medium. And I can just roll examples all day that would back up that claim. But actually, the counterargument is that in television in particular, in some ways it's the most genuine medium, because it's very, very hard to be disingenuous on television. So, for example, I could have a theoretical physicist on camera talk about his or her work or some aspect of his or her work, and the emotional intelligence of the audience would very easily discern when that researcher is truly passionate about something or not. And that is where emotion comes into the picture. Even if the ideas aren't clear, you can tell, you know, someone watching can say, I'm not quite sure what this is about, but I can tell that that person really cares about this. And, you know, one of the tasks of a storyteller is to try to bring that out. So that's one of the things that you find. And that's why you see things, people who've come to that insight. H.G. Wells is a good example, you know, both fiction and nonfiction writer, who weighed in on everything, as people did in the 1890s. He weighed in on this fact, on this point, saying that, the way you would construct a story like Edgar Allan Poe or Conan Doyle, that's how the science writer should be guided. He was talking about drama and suspense and mystery and adventure. BBC, 100 years later, just kind of boiled it down to this, and that's exactly how a lot of science for the public is done. That's why there's emotional content. It actually matters to people. So, the other way in which there's a big difference between the way journalists and researchers view the world is, of course, if you're a researcher, you're often becoming more and more specialized, for better or for worse. It's the blessing and the curse. Oops, something just happened. Did I just do that? Did I do that? Nope, that's my laser pointer. So, see if it'll come back. Oh, there we go. If you're a researcher, you tend to specialize. You learn more and more. A journalist is a born generalist. You become peripatetic. You become restless once you know too much about something. You want to move on to things you don't know very much about. And that comes out in interesting ways in terms of how journalists and scientists might respond to information. So I think this is also useful as a difference. And again, these are stereotypes, but I think it's useful to see these stereotypes if you haven't been exposed to them. So here's how I would portray most of science. It kind of falls into two categories, and this is something that we're coping with all the time, both at Nature and actually any science media job I've had. So whenever a result appears in peer-reviewed literature, there are a couple of predictable responses. So either it's going to be from researchers. I already know that. Everyone knows that. So if you call up a researcher and say, have you seen that paper? What do you think about it? A typical response is, this is nothing new. And I would say about half of the time, that's what people say. About the other half of the time, they'd say, nobody believes that. And that, from my humble perspective as a journalist, accounts for, I guess I'm saying 99.98% of reactions to published literature. It's quite sobering, actually, when you start talking to researchers all the time. So there is a tiny little bit where, and when you get more than one person to say that, you realize you've struck gold. So that's sort of what the journalist is aiming for. And of course, we all know cases where that's not the case, where things are overhyped, where they don't really matter, or things that really would be incredible are printed, but actually, in reality, there's a lot of skepticism about it, even though it's in a peer-reviewed, high-profile journal. And so it's kind of finding that little thing. Now, there's a reverse to this. I haven't assigned percentages to it, but I think if you're a researcher and you're talking to a journalist and trying to communicate what you think might be worth writing about, there's a kind of equivalent response. So I'm sure you've had this experience, but one of the things that you'll get is, okay, whatever, I don't know, whatever, I don't even know what you're telling me. So that's often a barrier right there, and even journal, it's very easy, even if you've covered science all your life. I mean, of course, if you're a general reporter, it's pretty, and if you've just gone from covering a fire on Main Street and now you're going to talk about theoretical physics, you can just imagine the huge challenge there. But even for people who cover theoretical physics all their lives, it's very easy if you're not a specialist to quickly get lost. Then there's the other point, which is, actually I do understand what you're saying, and I'm telling you it's not that interesting to a broader audience outside of the field, and that's sort of the key thing. And then there's the other problem, which, at first, if you're a young researcher and a journalist reacts this way to something you've said, you might think you're doing great, but it might not actually be such a good thing because they might actually be too naive and they might be just, what? There are such things as black holes? They might just be so out of it that you're not actually going to get a serious message through. And that kind of stuff often gets stopped by editors anyway. So you're doing well with a journalist if they actually want you to say more. And if you start feeling uncomfortable with how much you're telling them, then probably, the journalist is doing their job properly. So that's sort of the difference between the two areas. So finally, let me just talk about the audiences, because this is where a lot of things are said about science journalism, for example, that are very sweeping, and actually it really depends on who the intended audience is. Of course, there's a vast spectrum. There are many, many different publications, many media outlets, many different motivators and drivers. So you can chop these up in different ways. But I'm going to mention, I've come to think of it in three different categories, and I've worked in all the different categories. I can sort of see what the differences are. I'm going to start with the smallest audience of all, which is I would call it the professionally interested audience. So these are people actually who, in some way or another, their livelihood depends on science. Either they're scientists, or they're in some sort of closely associated support function, or they're investors that are following science, or teachers, or somehow what goes on in science actually matters to them professionally. And so, you know, that's precisely the kind of audience that Nature is targeting in particular. You know, if you're reading Nature, you're probably pretty deep into science. And so a lot of what we cover isn't even science. A lot of it is science policy. We actually have very few pure, what we call discovery science. Very little of that appears in our news pages. Then there's what I would call the casually interested audience. So these are people who are seeking out science, and they're seeking out outlets, but it's in a sense a kind of intellectual entertainment. It's pleasurable to learn about the world. And everyone can relate to this, because I think the road to becoming a scientist often begins with when you're first exposed to this kind of medium. You know, if you're like me and you know, you tried hard to, especially if you're as old as me, and back when Scientific American wasn't that easy to read, and you know, you kind of poured through every article trying to understand what it was, and or you know, if you really made an effort to kind of seek out science or you know, read the books and so on. So that's the casually interested audience, and that could include professional scientists who are, this is their leisure read, you know, they're reading outside of their field. This is the cosmologist reading about microbiology. And so, you know, at the moment, Scientific American is not a bad example of where that sits, because it's a consumer thing, and it's on the newsstand, and it's really trying to stimulate people. It's not something you have to do for your job. And then finally, there's the big audience, the real audience that most media is involved in. I would call it the casually disinterested audience. And journalists who are working in this kind of publication or outlet are going to treat you differently than the others. Casually disinterested to me means the readers are not coming there for science. When you turn the page of the Globe and Mail and there's a science story on page 4 or 5, a second before you did that, you weren't thinking that you were going to be looking for a science story. Maybe it'll catch your attention, maybe it won't. It's competing with all the other news of the day. So it has a completely different kind of agenda. So that's the casually interested audience. Time magazine is a good example. Here I'm just sticking with magazines. You know, on any given week, Obama might be on the cover of Time, or Hillary Clinton, or Putin, and or it might be Why Mom Liked You Best, and what new research shows about siblings. So science kind of is treated there as kind of part of the total pageant of human endeavor. So what makes it into these publications? And this is especially true of this broad mass media, because this is what reaches the most people. And by the way, almost all television is in that category, which is interesting to say. For example, if you wanted to have television equivalents of this, it's interesting. When I worked for Discovery Channel, we often sort of considered ourselves as the casually interested audience, you know, that we were after people who were interested in science and wanted to watch about science on television. But actually, we would frequently be reminded by our advertising department that it was really the casually disinterested audience. What really matters are the people clicking through on their remotes, and to try to stop them, you know, to try to hold them as they're clicking through. So, you know, even then, it would be people who weren't expecting science until the second they saw you. So what makes the news in this kind of environment? There's a really simple formula. It's basically anything that the editors deem is interesting and significant to the audience. And that's very subjective, but you can see it easily. I had picked up a copy of the Globe and Mail today, but I'm trying to remember what it was. There was a Pacific Rim story at the top, which is significant. That would fall mainly into the significant category because of trade with Asia. And then there is a photo and a kind of more personal story about Aung San Suu Kyi right below that, if you're remembering the front page of the Globe today. You had it right there on the front page. One is a little bit more significant to the Canadian economy. One doesn't have that much significance to our lives, but it's interesting because she's an interesting person and there's a kind of deeper resonance there. So you can play that game every single day with any newspaper and see which stories are kind of there because you know it's good for you, or you know that it has some kind of effect on you. And then there are other stories that are just there because they're just so interesting. And the editors have chosen to put those in front of you, or to kind of put that in front of your attention. And so The trick is that depending on the publication, what's significant and interesting can be quite different. And if you get into a very narrow audience, obviously, it's a whole, many, many assumptions are made. And, you know, in journalism, there's this cliche about inside baseball. So, for example, a writer might say to me, what about a story on this and this? And I'll say it's too inside baseball. Or sometimes we say too in the weeds. In other words, only someone in that field would really care about that. So, you know, only someone who's following baseball would care about this. So all of the levels of media that I was talking about are trying not to be this, unless they're specifically a trade magazine for that. But they're trying to reach out. And even Nature is trying not just to be for professional researchers, but it's for professional researchers, but the idea is anyone who, any educated person who wants to know what's important in science or how science is impacting the world could pick it up and maybe not do very well with the back half, with the peer-reviewed part, but with the front half, would get a good digest of what really matters that week. So it is still meant with the general audience in mind. So, and I was gonna say that one of the things that's a bit disappointing sometimes for researchers is finding out that basically, if they're in the interesting category, they're lucky. Of course, one, especially with physics, you know, one of the great conceits is that in the long term, it's going to be really significant. You know, something that is happening in theoretical physics today could be very significant to the world in 100 years or less or more, but maybe not in the newspaper tomorrow. So you're really in the interesting category when it's mass media, and you're kind of lucky if you're in the interesting category because just a lot of science isn't reported on because it just doesn't rise to that level of interest. But now I'm going to sort of give you the secret of what editors look for, because this is not all. So I'm going to finish up with this, and then we can actually maybe talk a little bit more. These days, I'm in the trenches. So I've had a number of different jobs. These days, I mainly assign other reporters and I edit their work. Freelancers call me all the time. People are pitching to me all the time, trying to figure out, you know, can I get this story into Nature? And so, like most editors, I can tell you, you know, I'm looking more and more like Jonah Jameson from Spider-Man. Every day I look in the mirror and I look more like that guy. I just don't have the cigar yet. But here's, you know, so again, it's dangerous to apply a stereotype or a list, but I just want to give you a sense of the thought process. Because this is also news. So if someone is coming to me for a story, or if a scientist is suggesting a story to me, my very first question silently as I'm listening to them speak to me is, why would I be reading about this now? Why now? Now, often there's a good answer. Sometimes there's something going on in the world and it makes sense that this is the right time to do it. But most stories that we would put up, there's some reason we're calling out to a particular event or a particular moment. Even if it's a broad topic, now is the time to talk about this topic, and we call that the peg. There's the interesting thing again, and I'm not gonna dwell on it, but you know, every story that's good has to have something irresistible about it, something that you just love, a piece of information that's delicious, that stimulates your curiosity or tells you something you really didn't know. So that's interesting. And then there's the new. This is tricky too because, and I say new to our target audience or new to our readers. You know, there could be a local story that's been in the papers for months, but maybe it's time for it to go international and it's new to that larger audience. But there has to be some freshness to it. Otherwise, you know, so for example, if you're telling me a story that Science or the New York Times ran last week, it's like, sounds great, it's already been done. We're gonna look for something else. And then this is the one that younger reporters often have a hard time with because it's easy to just tell stuff. People are doing stuff and it's just easy to say, oh, this person's doing something kind of interesting. But, you know, that doesn't go very far, especially when you're competing with other stories. And so there needs often to be a kind of struggle or tension because this is what people are keying in on. This is what people know matters. Because society, you know, our society is constructed in along lines of tension between opposing forces or interests that are moving in different directions. And one of the things that journalists should be doing and what makes good journalism is exposing those sources of tension. Where are people uncomfortable? Where do they think something should be different? It comes out in all kinds of different ways, but that's what you're hoping for in a story, and that makes it, you know, infinitely more interesting and readable and probably more significant. And the last thing is significant, which is why does this really matter? And for us, I mean, for the general reader in a mass market audience, a lot of what would be in Nature is not that significant because they're just not paying attention to the minutiae of science. For us, significance means something very important, something very particular. It means that people within the field would say, yes, that's important. But people out of the field would also agree, oh yeah, like they wouldn't necessarily say, I don't care. There's all kinds of news that's important only in that specialty. So what we're looking for are things that transcend the specialty, but also at the same time, people within the specialty wouldn't roll their eyes and say, oh, everyone knows that. You know, so it's gotta be the kind of thing that within the specialty, people would agree, yeah, this is one of the most important things that's happened to us in a long time, enough that people outside the specialty would take notice. So that's how we're trying to put it together. Now, if you want to remember all of this, there's an easy way to do it. And especially for journalists, we just, you know, it's the, I work for a British publication, so that actually sort of makes it easy. Just think of those pints at the end of the day. And that's how you can checklist your story. So the last thing I want to mention is that there are many constraints, as I've said, and there's actually, there are problems in the field. The business model that supports a lot of this activity isn't working very well, and that's why the Globe and Mail is offering early retirement, why some papers are publishing less frequently, and every media outlet has various concerns about how this is going to be supported. This is a bigger question long term, but at the moment, that's a force. So here's what I would say is worth noting. Why do I have Lady Gaga up here? So it's an attention grabber. But Lady Gaga is just one sliver of what you could describe as a kind of increasing sophistication of online presentation. You know, it used to be that YouTube was a bunch of amateurs putting up amateur videos, and now it's professional broadcast, you know, it's professional quality production, whether it's a Lady Gaga video or something else. That's increasingly dominating the online landscape. And the other thing that's dominating the landscape is the accessibility of this material through a device that can both be text and video and sound and all at once. And I think we haven't even begun to understand how that's going to change how we present things. But those are the trends, and it's going to, you know, we're in the middle of that right now. So there are exciting possibilities, but at the heart of that is still the interest in telling stories. So now I'm really going to stop. And actually, I'd love to hear from you if you have any questions, but I have some questions to ask as well. So there we go.
I just wanted to piggyback on Ivan's presentation today. Since we're talking about the media, I thought this was a good opportunity to remind everyone here who may already know, or those of you who are new to Perimeter, because we haven't done media colloquium for a long time, as to what the Perimeter External Relations team here can do to help when you get an incoming media request here. So we're happy to work with you and help you out and do some of the legwork a little bit so that you understand that request and what's actually being asked of you, so that the journalists can come out with what they're looking for and have a pleasant experience, and you can as well. So I just wanted to go through a few things, and one to point out the three members of the external relations team here that deal with media, specifically is John Matlock, who couldn't be here today but will be by later on today, and many of you know him, myself, and RJ Taylor, who graced us with his presence earlier. And feel free to contact us anytime you guys have any questions, whether today or later on, and loop us in when you do have a media inquiry. Got a few things to go through here. These are some of the guidelines, some of the kind of general everyday stuff that we do with media interactions here at Perimeter, but it really is transportable to any organization or anywhere where you are dealing with media. So whether you're a visitor here or one of our residents, these should be pretty useful for you. So one of the things that RJ, John, and I really try and do for our researchers here is when an inquiry does come in, we want to go and do a little bit of a background check and just understand that request for you, and so that everything's clear with the journalists as to what you can expect. So what is the publication? What is the audience? Ivan touched on this a little bit earlier, and you might have a bit of a different approach or come at things from a different level of conversation with the journalist depending on the audience. Where is the audience? Is it print? Is it television? Is it online? What's the focus of the story? What are likely questions? Who else will be interviewed? Et cetera, et cetera. And remember, you can decline the request, whether for a myriad of reasons, whether it's just not something that's really of interest to you, you don't have time to do it, or whatever it may be, and that's okay too. Next thing to understand is dealing with deadlines. So media are working off a 24-hour clock, and with the World Wide Web, everything is moving quicker and quicker these days. So their clock might not be your clock, so this does require commitment. And if the timing is too tight, it's okay to say no again. No comment is better than a quote or a full article you may come to regret a little bit later. So one thing else, another thing that RJ and I or John will try to do is obtain an ability to fact check, and this is something that you need to do before you grant the interview. It's really hard to get later. And it just ensures that you'll be contacted after the story is drafted, but before it goes to publication. And it doesn't mean that you're going to get to see the full story or that you get to edit the story, but it should give you a little bit of context as to how your comments are used within that story or information is used. And Ivan could probably comment on that a little bit more if you're curious. Another thing, and Ivan, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this as well, is ensuring what is on or off the record. We always like to think that nothing is truly off the record, but you'll know the scope of the interview going into it. If you are in doubt, feel free to ask the reporter. And if you do want to say something is off the record, like I said, nothing's really ever off the record, so it doesn't mean your info won't be used, and the reporter may seek another source, but generally you've just provided a tip, is one way to look at it. Going into your interview, you're going to want to be prepared, so you may want to review past stories by that reporter or from that outlet, and we're happy to provide those and look those up for you. Review your content, and you may want to talk to some others in your field as well to get a sense of the topic and a little bit more what seems to be the chatter in your field about that subject matter. Be yourself. This is sometimes easier said than done, but be who you are. The reporter's talking to you because they want to be talking to you. Be relaxed. Again, easier said than done sometimes, but you're in a conversation with someone and they're talking to you because they're genuinely curious. And also remember that you're an ambassador for science, for physics, for Perimeter, and your colleagues. Know your limits, and it's okay to say, I don't know. So if something's asked that's outside your comfort zone, defer to others who may have more knowledge in that field, or just say, I don't know, and that's okay. Provide supporting info as needed, so whether it's links to related info, other contacts, you may want to recommend some other researchers that the journalist may want to speak to, and photos, diagrams, or materials that they're requested. It could be a lot of help in trying to visualize a concept, especially I think in physics when you're trying to explain it. When it does come in, sometimes this does happen, sometimes mistakes happen, and no one wants to see it, the reporter, the editor, or you, and it is possible to seek a correction. Couple tricks to it. You do have to be quick, and it's better if you are specific. So just one, we have some resources here that we use to monitor media and track what's coming, but one standard go-to and easy way to do it is just to look for a Google alert, and if we know your story is coming, we'll usually watch for it. But usually your Google alert will come through just as the story is published online, and most stories now, even if it's for a print issue, you'll often get the online publication specifically for a newspaper before it goes to print the next day. And what you'll want to do is as soon as you see it, if there is a little error, contact the reporter or the editor immediately and aim to update the online version as soon as possible. Now with the web, things spread really quickly, so you usually want to try and get that online story updated before it spreads to another source. And at the end of it all, you want to thank the reporter. He or she worked really hard to champion your story, and Ivan can attest to that. They respected you, and you're building a relationship as well. It's a really small community, and you're becoming a source among reporters, and you are likely to meet again. So it's a good way just to end everything on a good note. So there's the list once again, but you don't need to take notes to remember it, because you've got John, RJ, and myself, and you can always reach one of us. So I don't want to take too much of your time. I want to bring Ivan back up here and go through a Q&A. We'll have some more time as well during high tea. But there's microphones on either side of the theater right now, so please come down to ask questions so that we can record it for PeerSef or anyone who's watching later. So Ivan.
Looks like Lee has a question. It's not for us to say that's, and by that I mean, in a way, what's in the news is outside of our control. What put it in the news was when the team began speaking about it, and so this is where the media has to react. And I learned a lesson like this. I'm going to get to the superluminal neutrinos, but I learned a lesson like this when I was a correspondent for Discovery. And I was at a conference at a time when NASA put out, they had a television press briefing with what they claimed was the first visual image of a planet. And I don't know if people remember this. This is like going back to the mid-90s. Now there really are visual images of planets around other stars. An extrasolar planet. This was a case where it looked like an object, very faint, very small, beside a double star system. And the claim was it looked like it might have escaped from that system. Maybe this was a planet that was ejected from the double star system. There was immediate skepticism. But it was a peer-reviewed paper, press release. The researcher was up on stage. NASA set the whole thing up. There's a more recent example of this with the arsenic-based life that I'm just not even going to talk about. But I remember Discovery Channel really wanted to talk about that, and they were sending a crew to ask me about it, to comment on it. And I was busy at this conference actually learning something real. And I just thought, no one believes this. And I said, don't bother. Just send the truck back, send the crew back. So actually, I got in trouble for that because, it was the sense that everyone else is talking about this. And if we don't show up and say something about it, we've kind of somehow dropped the ball for the viewers. Now, how we handled the faster-than-light neutrinos, I think, like a lot of responsible science media, was to put the skepticism out there to appropriately say, this is, if true, this would be significant for all sorts of reasons. However, there is skepticism. And I have to say, it's very hard for journalists to feel satisfied about their coverage of that sort of thing. I think everyone always feels they get a little bit too caught up in the excitement, even if they're being very cautious and putting in all the caveats. It's hard not to get swept up in the moment. So there are definitely pitfalls there. But it's also hard to say we shouldn't cover this. Now, there are times where we do this. There are times where we say this is just too trivial. But I don't think faster than light neutrinos was one of those cases because the field was kind of agitated by it. So I think there was a sense that we had to say, okay, something's going on here. It's, a lot of people are looking at it sideways, but there it is. And there were real repercussions, I think, for the team. And there were tensions within the team. And so we reported on that as well. Four is to think a little bit to think of a skeleton, for example, where it's like science is built up of the big giant bones, like the femurs and the long bones of the body. And, if you sort of think of it as this massive construction with these major pieces. So in a sense, what journalists are focusing on are not those big pieces, but on the turning points, on the joints, on the places where things go together, at a place where a direction changes. So it's one of those things that's, this is where we're constrained by human nature. People pay attention to something when something changes. So, and this is why they're one of the pitfalls, there are many ways to criticize science journalism, and I invite the criticism. One of the big pitfalls is putting too much emphasis on what looks like a turning point, a breakthrough. This could change everything faster than light neutrinos. That would be a major turning point, except if it's not really a turning point. So there's a sense of looking for things that might change the game. And you want to catch those things that are real. You don't want to be in a situation where you're not flagging something that actually is quite important. But it's tough, because if you're a journalist, you're not a specialist, and even specialists often don't see the true significance of something until afterwards. And one of my example of this is, I think if I was ever present for history in the making, real history in the making in science, I remember a press conference in 1998 when the first results it was a AAAS conference, and the first results of the supernova surveys that would lead to the realization that there's something called dark energy, those results were presented. And it was the weirdest press conference I've ever attended. There was no way you would have understood that there was history in the making before your eyes. the scientists were extraordinarily cagey. No one, there was both a sense that no one quite understood what was going on, like among the researchers, and even then there was a sense that no one wanted to be quoted saying that the universe is accelerating. So the press conference was kind of in the form of, here's the data. And kind of describing it in technical terms. And it was a long press conference because there's a lot to describe. But after it was over, no one had any questions. The only question someone could ask was, could you say that all over again? And it was that distance. And that was actually, that was a real thing. Like, that has changed an entire field and has defined, you know, funding streams and paths. And you could say, oh, that was history in the making right there. But you couldn't recognize it at the time. So it's a moving target. There is another answer to that. This is why the trend story was invented. You know, so a journalist who's perceptive about a field, and we try and do this actually, is, you know, now's the time to talk about this shift. It's tricky because there still has to be a reason to talk about this now. And why does there have to be a reason? Because, you know, in the old days, you used to say, we only have so many pages, and we have to decide what we're going to put in the pages. Of course, now you can have an infinite number of information, an infinite amount of information, infinite number of pages or stories because of the internet, but attention is limited. So you still have to make a decision about what's the most important thing. So that's tricky because those stories, you know, news is current, and those stories command less information. This is why science journalists often go off and write books, because they feel like no one is talking about this big thing, and it's lurking in the background, and it's going to change everything, and the only way to get at it is to write a book, is to like really go in depth. So the problem is, if you're only getting your information in that kind of daily sporadic news way, you miss that, and there's no immediate cure for that. I have to say one thing that Lee said about, you know, when do you decide to what if it's too premature to talk about a story? It depends on what you mean by premature. And of course, one of the things that hampers science journalists, unlike other fields of journalism, is this whole cycle with embargoes and journals and not being able to talk about certain things before they're published, even though everyone knows them. And then what happens if you talk about it at a conference and a journalist is at a conference? So there's this weird dance. So, you know, one version of the when is it too soon to talk about a paper, well, a researcher might say, I'd love to talk to you more about this, but my collaborator is hoping for tenure and we think this could be a Nature paper, so I wish I could talk about it, but I can't because, blah, blah. So all kinds of, you know, and it's like, really, we could be talking about this now, but because of the way the system works. So this is also an ongoing dilemma for people. Because if you really do the job and you understand the science and you're ahead of everyone else, you're not rewarded because then you have to wait and talk about it like everyone else at the same time. So that's another dilemma. It depends a little bit on what the appetite is for it. But astronomy is a good example because there's actually a lot of appetite, this popular appetite for astronomy. So you can have journalists that say work for Sky and Telescope magazine, and within that crowd there are some people who write about X-ray astronomy and some people who write about cosmology and some people who write about planetary, and that's supported because there's enough of an audience. So the thing is, you can get arbitrarily close to a field and then still find that there's stuff that you don't know because, you know, the mesh gets narrower and narrower. So it becomes a practical issue, like how specialized can someone be, because how often are we going to run a story about this or that? And often what happens is reporters tend to have areas where they go very deep, you know, where they've followed a line of reporting for a period of time and they know an area very well, but then they're more general in other places. And that's just sort of the economics of it. A related question is whether journalists need to have any specialization at all, and it depends on the publication. It's certainly, you know, a lot of our reporters have PhDs and have a research background before they come into Nature. That's obviously not true in a daily newspaper environment. So in a daily newspaper environment, there's more value to being able to be assigned to be anything and cover anything, because whatever is making news that day is what needs to be covered. It's a little bit like the difference between coming from a hometown so that you know that hometown very well and having a driver's license where we could send you to that town because you can get there. And so sometimes people who come from research and want to become journalists, there's that sense, oh, because I have a PhD and I know, I'm not saying people here would say that, but you know, that you have that sense that I know a lot, so therefore I should be good at this. But it's a little bit like coming from a place and not having the driver's license, because it's being able to turn it around and turn it into news, that there's still that basic skill set that's required. So at Nature, it's interesting because we sort of have both. We really need people who can really work as journalists and be very effective at asking very hard questions and pushing and trying to uncover new information. And I especially mean about policy and so on, not necessarily just about new research that hasn't been published yet, but more about, you know, what's really going on here. And at the same time, they have to be able to really, you know, when someone is talking about a particular molecular pathway or you know, a particular aspect of cosmology, they've got to be able to keep up. And it's hard to actually find people that have both, but that's what we look for. There's overlap and there's a blend, and I think that it's a lot less comfortable to be a science reporter, given all of, you know, comfortable in the sense, you know, where stories would just fall into your lap, you'd get the press release, oh, here's what's going to come out in Nature or Science this week. You know, that's what it was like, I think, in the 80s, you know. The internet wasn't there, so people didn't have rapid access to results. People would have to physically go to a conference to see results announced, and then they would report them. They would get their comments from people there. It sounds idyllic and easy and lovely. And now it's much more, and so I think the point is, if you're going to be a journalist, you need to expect more. So, I mean, it could be from the scientist blogger, but an easier way to test yourself, if you're thinking about an article, if you're a journalist, you should be asking yourself, am I writing something that is just gonna appear on Wikipedia in 15 minutes? And if so, why am I doing this? So there needs to be value added, and the value added can come in different ways. It can come in the form of analysis, you know, that may come with sort of applying a certain kind of expertise or a certain kind of critical approach to something. It may come from just tremendously gifted narrative, just telling that story amazingly well. It may come from, I mean, for some it comes from in the form of opinion, you know, or kind of pushing something in a certain direction, but there are ways of adding value so that it's more than just, oh, I'm explaining something. And I think scientists, bloggers are doing a fabulous job at some of those things. Some of them are. And of course, for us, it's very interesting to watch when they battle each other in the blog. So it's morphing into all sorts of other cultural phenomena. So I have a question for you, which maybe I would happily pursue with you later, which is, and this is why I'm here, is we don't actually cover that much theoretical physics in Nature for various reasons. We could debate the reasons. We cover things like the Higgs boson, you know, like some newspapers would cover the Queen of England. And I think there's going to be a lot of Higgs boson news very soon, actually. But on the theoretical side, not very much. And I would love it. You don't have to blurt it out in public, because I can understand why people wouldn't want to. But But if you have private thoughts about things that you think should be covered and that you haven't seen covered, I would love things that should be written about, or things that, you know, and maybe not specific results or specific, just sort of, here's something that no one's writing about. I would love to hear that, to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.